Hello and welcome to the Echo Chamber podcast. But well, it's kind of an Echo Chamber podcast, but it's also a bit of a Pack Woman podcast, you know, because we're having a bit of a crossover here this evening. I'm delighted to be joined by the host of the new podcast, the Pack Woman podcast, Linda Hayden. Linda, how are you?
I am good, thank you very much. Busy, busy, busy.
Yeah, busy's been and just on your own podcast, did you anticipate that it would go get off to such a flyer?
No, absolutely not. No. I can say I've been walking around in a state of shock all week. So we got to number two in the iPod news commentary chart by day two. Yeah. So I was fairly shocked about that. But now I feel an awful pressure because...
The only way is down. Trust me. Stop looking at them. Just follow. Just live on the feedback and the good positive vibes that you get from it.
I blame Caroline West because she is the one who has introduced me to the fact that there are actual charts there, and I'm obsessed with statistics.
Yeah.
It's all Caroline's fault.
Well, congratulations. It's a lovely podcast, but it's not. It's a very dark podcast. Right?
It is. And the thing is, like, I'm thinking about the episodes that are coming up because I've got seven in the bag now. And there is literally one that's not heavy duty. So if you're into easy listening, might not be for you. It is informative. You will learn loads.
Go back and listen to my podcast with Colm O'Regan. It's funny. Okay. Yeah. Anyway, much more importantly, we're delighted to be joined on the line by a returning world champion. I know. Paul Hosford of the Irish Examiner is here. He is one half of the team that broke the Golfgate story. He is also he's also someone who I've known for a number of years, and I've absolutely filled with delight to see him get the plaudits for the work that he's done over the last few weeks. It is so well deserved, but it's not just been something that happened overnight. I want to be very clear on that. Paul, you were slugging away on the old in the journal when we spoke, and I don't mean that in a negative connotation of the journal. What I mean about that is you'd be doing things about, you know, let's do the polls, let's do this. You were doing all of that. Now, how have you found the last couple of weeks?
Well, the last week has been mental. We're now nearly exactly a week away from when we hit publish. Mm. So, like, that's been crazy. But the last couple of months have been nuts. I started with the Examiner on the 2nd of March. Mm. The week after, the 9th of March, was the day that Leo Varadkar, Simon Coveney, Simon Harris and Tony Holohan gave that briefing in government buildings. There was tons of journalists there, and it was delayed by about an hour and a half, and I had kind of come down with a cold, and everyone was there to hear about COVID-19, and nobody really knew what was going on, and the place went silent at one point, and I let out a massive sneeze. And then Leo and the two Simons came in and gave us this really, really stark briefing. I remember walking out, and all of the journalists who've been through the wars, like, were coming out of government buildings, and we were all, nobody said a word, you know. This was the day after the Sunday Business Post had said that 84,000 people could die.
Yeah.
We're talking about an overrun health service. You were talking about morgues being set up in IMA. You know, so everyone was a bit freaked. But the following morning, I got up, I woke up, and my wife said to me, I think I'm going into labour. So
that's right. Yeah,
I stayed home that day. We ended up going into the rotunda about 5 p.m. that evening. Got in there for about 6, and the following evening at 7:30, just after 7:30, my son arrived. Managed to avoid all of the visitor restrictions. Brought him home. Was on 2 weeks paternity leave then, and got back, and I couldn't go into the Dáil, and government formation was kind of. At that stage, it was kind of a standoff, so COVID was the only game in town, but then government formation kind of kicked off, and then we were into Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael talks for a couple of weeks, and then we were into government formation talks, which took the guts of 6 weeks. And since then, you know, the actual government's been formed. 2 weeks after that, Barry Cowan, a couple of weeks after that, this, and in between, all manner of big stories. So there's been no real breathing room. I'm starting my holidays on Friday evening. I'm off for 2 weeks, and I'm hoping to have some kind of respite, but I don't see it coming.
Yes, you know what happened to poor Gavin Riley last week. So
there's no holidays in this game, apparently, which. Unless you're out in Clifton,
I'm fascinated by a couple of things. Obviously, you know, you spoke about the fact that from your own personal perspective, you know, your son was born in the middle of this. You had to go through the restrictions of, you know, when was it then that your parents were able to actually see your son?
So my parents came over on Paddy's Day, because at that stage you could do social distancing. So they were kind of, they were in the kitchen and he was kind of at the door of the sitting room kind of thing. Mm. They were able to hold him. We felt comfortable enough when he was about 12 or 13 weeks. So they kind of missed out on that, and they'd missed out on that because they were being very, very careful. So we were kind of like, you just kind of leave it. So yeah, we got to a point where at about 12 weeks, we were just saying, look, you could, are you going to do this for the next 2 years? You're kind of, like, none of these people are out and about in massive ways. We're not out and about in massive ways. Like, mm-hmm. At that stage, case numbers were way down. So you were comfortable enough.
Yeah, but the reason I asked that, because I kind of knew the answer, but the reason I asked that is to put that in perspective of what actually did happen in Clifton and how, you know, the things that happened and how the sacrifices, you know, everybody else made in terms of what we did, in terms of how we put our lives on pause, how we didn't go into those social interactions. And I just want to, you know, show that how real it is, even for the guy who broke the story, you know. When you're in the mix and you're doing the Paul Corr job, though, like you're only there, and then you come in the middle of the biggest global pandemic or the biggest story possibly of our lifetimes. It must have been such a baptism of fire.
Yeah, it makes the job a bit different as well, because a lot of the job is getting to know people, and if they're not around Leinster House, you can't really get to know them. And the corridors of Leinster House aren't really built for social distancing. So if you're trying to have a quiet conversation with somebody from 2 meters away, it's difficult enough. So you're trying to build that profile on the phone, and you're trying to get to know people on the phone. And then when you see them in Leinster House, you're saying, here, that was me that you were on the phone for 20 minutes just to put a face to a name. So it's taken a lot more effort. And then, like, particularly the TDs who aren't in Dublin a lot, or haven't, when the doll was sitting in that proportional kind of representation way where only certain members were getting calls every week, it was harder to see people who might not be up or who might not be speaking in the chamber at the time, whereas on a regular day the place is a lot busier, and you might just catch TD outside of the chamber or in the coffee dock or whatever, and because a lot of your kind of relationship building comes in within the building and just having chats with people, and that's kind of gone out the window. So yeah, it's been difficult. Luckily enough, you know, I had that kind of that experience in the journal, and was able to kind of rely on that and lean on the fact that I knew some people, because I'd spent a bit of time in Leinster House, kind of backing up Christina Finn at times. So enough people knew me that I was able to kind of make my introductions that way, you know, that kind of way. So yeah, it changed, like, for everybody. Anyone who has started a job this year has had their the process of kind of, yeah,
but it's very different for you guys, because we do refer to the Leinster House bubble, and you know, you're trying to make your imprint there. I suppose if I could go specifics on what's happened, and maybe Linda, actually, you did a timeline a few days ago and I think it was trending on Twitter, the Phil Hogan's crime spree.
Yeah.
Go on, give us a flavour of just some of the stuff people were contributing and talking about.
Well, it's so weird, because I started literally by just the facts of, this is what he did, here, here, here and here. And it was kind of like, he went playing golf in Limerick, and, you know, he did this. And then people started adding to it. So things like, you know, his family was involved in hair coursing, and he'd owned a greyhound with other Fine Gael members, where there had been a fine because the dog wasn't being cared for. And like, people were literally sending me everything. So I started adding it all in, and I made sure, you know, that I had the backup there, that it's been, you know, it had had a story done about it or anything like that. And it just grew legs to the point where nobody could ignore the fact that this guy had been getting away with this for so long. He had had no accountability whatsoever, except back when he leaked the budget 4 hours early when he had to resign back then. But then it was like, get the head down and we'll get you back in. So I was kind of amazed because I hadn't expected it. I'd literally just gone, geez, he's after doing loads. Let's just get it all in one place. And that's where I started with that. And then it grew legs. So,
and Paul, you'd when you said the idea of chasing the hare, kind of, you must have been chasing hares all over the country looking for some of this information for different things.
Yeah. And to be honest, part of this job is chasing dead ends. You know, you might spend a day chasing. So when the tip came into the news desk to myself and Aoife, you start off, and if you've set your day out, there can sometimes be this kind of weariness about chasing something like that, because you're like, oh, I'm going to chase this now, and the event didn't happen, or it was like somebody just printed off the seating list, but nothing actually happened, or they were all outside, or, you know, it complied in some technical way. So you start to run it down, and it was kind of around about the middle of the afternoon where we started to kind of get somewhere with it, and you were going, hang on, this will get published. And then you start going, I think this might be the front page. And then you're into a discussion, because we work in a paper, of like, are we going to hang on to it? Are we going to let it go? And the decision was made, look, we didn't think that we were the only ones chasing it. So you make that decision, but also we thought, like, this kind of needs to be out there straight away. Since then, the amount of tips and the amount of random tip-offs that we've gotten, sightings of Phil Hogan around the country kind of thing, different things about other people who were at it, or even just things that are completely unrelated that we're chasing down now that are far and away nothing to do with this. People just get this idea, like, oh, if I know somebody's chasing something, I'll throw them something else and they might be able to chase it down for me. Because, you know, even one of the people who had sent it to us was kind of, they weren't out for blood, they were just genuinely curious. Like, could you let me know if this happened? Was how they worded it. They didn't think, maybe they did in their own head think it was the cause for resignations and sackings or whatever, but it wasn't how they couched it to us. There was no vengeance there. It was just like, I think this might have happened. Can you let me know if it did?
But even the mix of people that was there, you would never have put, you know, like, if you're talking about Oireachtas Golf Committee, for me, that's like the lads just that are currently in the Oireachtas playing golf. The breadth of people that were at that dinner, and the reason. And you have to, you know, there's all sorts of questions come up since about the likes of, well, what were the papers that he stopped in to collect, and, you know, that were so important? And, you know, when was he getting a chance to do all of his trade negotiations when he was playing golf for 2 days and at a dinner? You know, it raised a lot of questions with the normal public, you know. I mean, never mind those of us that kind of keep an eye on things and watch, like, have you seen, you know, like, a lot of stuff like that people are kind of connecting a lot of dots now because of it?
Yeah, I think what people are connecting the dots on is that kind of, and I've written about this in the last week, is that kind of that link between modern Ireland or official Ireland, that be it the judiciary and politicians and very high profile broadcaster who was there, that kind of nexus that exists. I think a lot of people are kind of having that confirmed in their heads. I think what was interesting and what made me realize, like, Aoife tweeted the story almost as soon as it went live, and she would have a she would have a bigger Twitter following than me. So I was kind of interested to see how it did on her Twitter. And within 20 minutes, it was taken off. And I was kind of going to her, shit, like this is because, you know, you spend a lot of time and
you
reference that bubble. And sometimes when you're in the bubble, you think something's a bigger story than the public does.
Yeah.
And you can spend ages. You're like, look at this story that I've got. It's huge. And people are going, I don't give a shit.
Yeah.
Like sometimes you think that like a small procedural thing or something to do with the Dáil Business Committee is this huge thing and it's interesting to a couple of thousand people on Twitter, but like the general public just doesn't give a shit. So you have that kind of fear then when it goes live, like, is this something I'm after spending my day on this now? I'm trying to get other stuff done. Is it possible that we've kind of over-egged this in our own heads? But the second it started to take off, then you were going, hang on, this is big. Mm. And but the following day was what really hammered home to me. You know, like we knew that the story had done well online. We knew it had gotten traction. Derek Cleary had resigned and you were kind of going, okay, this is going to run. But it was Liveline the following day that really, really hit home to me because, and people have referenced it, and I've done a good bit of local radio in the last week. And all of their opinion shows, their morning shows were flooded the following day with the same reaction. And at times with political scandals in Ireland and scandals all over the world, some of the anger is political anger. It's manufactured outrage and it's bad faith outrage, like trying to get angry at something.
It's tribal. We have something on them. Let's get them.
Yeah, exactly. And we pretend that we're more hurt and we pretend that it's worse than it was. But this was people from Fine Gael, people from Fianna Fáil, people from Labour across the political divide were texting me going, that is outrageous. You know, people telling me, like, people were texting me first thing Friday morning saying every person in there should resign, especially the ones in my party. And you were kind of going, okay, this is... But when you heard people's actual hurt at it on Liveline, you thought, Jesus, this is real. People are genuinely, genuinely upset. They're genuinely hurt by it. And I think we're all living with this. It's nearly 6 months now. We've all modified our behaviours. We've all missed out on things that we wanted to do. Life's been kind of, like, it's been kind of crap in a way. You're all just, like, and you're at that point now where you're just fed up. The weather's getting crap again. And you're just like, just give us something, give us some kind of hope. And then you realise that this has gone on. And I think people they were just so fed up and just so angry.
They were ready for it.
I think so. And I think what it did was it gave a face to the whole pandemic anger.
Want to be clear on something, because you've written a little bit about this yourself, and I again advise people, you know, check out the go buy the paper or go online, get a subscription, you know, check out the it has to be paid for. But when you go and you check it, one of the important things that you've pointed out is because there's a second narrative to this now that developed fairly quickly, that, you know, it's cancel culture, it's the mob, it's this, and it was like, you know, that sort of nonsense, and it is nonsense. It was an affront to the people who told their stories and shared their lived realities.
I think it's an affront to everyone's intelligence to say this is cancel culture. Nobody got cancelled. People lived with the consequences of their actions.
There you go.
And I mean, you have to. Derek Cleary, and it came out very, very quickly, and a lot of commentators would have jumped on some of the Paul cores for the way they spoke about Derek Cleary. Derek Cleary is a genuinely, genuinely decent bloke. Really, really nice man. People across Leinster House like him a lot. You know, is a Fianna Fáil true believer, believes in their politics. You know, people disagree with him politically, but everyone has time for him. And I felt that his resignation felt very decent. But he didn't, you know, nobody's saying he got cancelled. He admitted that he made a mistake. He admitted that the mistake that he made was of a sufficient level that he could no longer adequately tell people what to do from a ministerial position. And he resigned. It was a very straight line. You know, we didn't have to tear down statues of him or go march on Ballina to get him to resign. He accepted that what he had done was wrong and he resigned. There's no cancel culture there. The Phil Hogan thing is funny to me because people are saying now that like, you know, a Fine Gael councillor accused me of like listing the heads that I'd collected. And it was never like, it's never ever been about collecting heads. I think the Phil Hogan story, the reason that it ended in his resignation is that it was drip fed and it was unclear. And there were still questions that he, you know, when you submit a 20 page dossier to your boss and there's still questions, then it's only like, I think it's not unpredictable or it's not mob culture that you end up resigning.
He probably wouldn't have had to resign if he had dealt with it in the same as quickly as Dara Cleary had and said, these are my reasonings and this is my outline and I will now go and put them straight to my employer in effect in the European Parliament. And he did not do that. We were on apology number 4, I think, by the time he went to his 20-page dossier, you know, and
he still missed stuff out as well. Yeah. Like there was 2 instances where he wasn't transparent. You know, he went to Roscommon and that wasn't in there, you know? And he was spotted out and about on the grounds of the K Club and that wasn't in there. So if you're gonna say something, tell the truth. You know, if you're gone to the point where you're gonna be held accountable for, stop lying. Like just stop leaving stuff out.
Yeah.
I think for us, you know, we were asking the first questions about Kildare and about his movements on Friday afternoon, and the negative COVID test defense came out on Tuesday. I think if that's going to be your defense, let it be your defense straight away.
Immediately.
Just come out and say, look, I appear to have misinterpreted a citizen's advice page. Here's the page that I read. If I got it wrong, I'm incredibly sorry. I shouldn't have done it. Hands up, mea culpa. And then we all move on. Like, I think the Taoiseach and the Tánaiste have both kind of said that the drip feed doesn't help. And it was the same with the Barry Cowan story where it just dripped out and it dripped out and that doesn't help. But they always say in scandals within the media, if it runs to 2 Thursdays or 2 Sundays, then the person is likely gone. We were kind of saying, you know, somebody said to me yesterday, if it lasts till tomorrow, he'll be gone. I thought by yesterday it was fairly obvious it was inevitable. Because if the European Commission president is going to keep you, her spokesperson will come out and say, yeah, he's staying, we're confident in him, and we move on. And they don't have time for distractions. They just draw a line under it and they move on regardless of what people, because they're not held accountable in the same way.
I'm sorry now because I've got a slight change in tack here, but I want to ask you about everybody's seen the clip at this stage, but you asking the questions then to Stephen Donnelly and unfortunately his new special advisor Colette Sexton kind of tried to intervene. What was your take on that?
Look, you know, I think we both have 2 very different jobs to do. I think from her point of view, she probably felt that the minister had answered the questions. I didn't feel that the minister had or hadn't answered my specific question. Like I would always be of the opinion that like if I'm there, I'll ask whatever question I want. If I end up asking him what his favourite colour of dog is, that's between me and my employer. My job, my boss can tell me to ask a better question. But the question of the day was about this incident. It was less than 24 hours later that had been published, so it was obviously going to be asked. So yeah, look, I just think it was a case of 2 people having 2 different kind of I suppose different objectives in the room. And
I would say one thing for that. It's hard to set, put that all on Colette Sexton's door. Some of that comes from the minister who maybe told her in advance. You know, ultimately, she's answerable to him and he may have, you know. So we don't know what the diktat is, but you would have to say, you know, if you go into a room and you're told, listen, you know, let's limit the damage on that. That was, she's doing her job ultimately. So it is about that. As this rolls,
I can't say one way or the other what was in the room there, and that, you know, like I said, I just kind of felt like, you know, like I tweeted afterwards, like, it's up to the minister whether or not he answers it. It's up to the journalist whether or not they ask it. So, but that's how I would always see the relationship. I think it got picked up on then, and kind of when it became a bigger thing. But for me, it was kind of a bit of a brief run in with an advisor, and we move on. Like,
if I was to take it forward, okay, so now you've got the maelstrom, it's all over, you're on the New York Times is quoting you, you know, you've gone around the world, and now your feet are back on the ground, and all the talk is changed to, you know, obviously the government needs to just put it in the past and move on. Do you think we're going to be able to move on as quickly as they want us to?
Yeah, I think so. I think we move, because, like, in any other news cycle, maybe not, but COVID is still with us. There's probably, you know, we're expecting news tomorrow on pubs and on what's going to happen in Kildare over the coming weeks, and, like, whether or not we could end up in a second lockdown. You know, I think the government will want to just draw a line under this, get the replacement in quickly, get Derek Leary's replacement in quickly, and then just move on. I think it might happen. Because the thing about it is, I don't think anyone was baying for blood. You know, like, in a way, I think people wanted to see accountability more than they wanted to see a head roll just for the sake of it. Because sometimes we can do that. We can say somebody has to be sacked over this, and you're going to go, well, to what end or for what offence? And I think people have seen, not everyone in that room be held accountable, but the vast majority of the elected officials in that room were held accountable. And then there's an ongoing process with Seamus Wolfe, which may or may not find that he breached some rules.
I think the Seamus Wolfe one is very interesting, and I think the public won't forget about that, because, and I know particularly, and again, as an engaged person, I won't forget about it, because there's a long track record of his advice at the time with the Attorney General when it was used. I would think we used the equivalent, we were talking to someone yesterday in one of the that works was working on the family reunification bill that got stopped last year because of the money message. And we said, the money message, when they replaced the, under advice of the Attorney General, didn't work, we'll just use the money message, you know. And there was very much a political tool in that. So I think the public will watch that, but I do suspect you're right insofar as that most people will move on. You know, there's a lot of, I think the phrase around Brian Hayes was quite funny when the Sunday Business Post said he didn't think he's lost credibility, and I said, absolutely not, he has lost no credibility, because, you know, and that's his job as someone in the Banking Payments Federation, in many ways, is a lobbyist. Let's be honest, and I can say that. Linda, you want to come in?
Yeah, I don't think it's done. I don't think it's even nearly done. I think the Seamus Wolfe thing, like, I did my little thread today on Seamus Wolfe. As I was saying to Tony earlier, I've had like 400 new followers on Twitter as a result. Now, I'm just pulling other people's stuff together into one place. But there are a lot of people very closely watching what's going on there. And also, the question keeps coming up about why Brian Hayes and Seamus Wolfe were there at the same time. What's going on? And, you know, where's the accountability? Like, who's going to hold the government to account if we've got Supreme Court justices who are playing golf with the lads? You know, I think there's a lot more. I don't think it's done, nearly done yet.
And the one thing I would say to that is, it just showed everybody that whether you want to call it the Galway tent or the Golden Circle or all of these things like that, and I think, Paul, you put it at the outset, like, it gave us something that we long suspected. It just crystallized that.
Yeah, and you get the chance to see it written down as well. I think one of the things that's kind of, I suppose, sometimes we look for a deeper kind of meaning to these things. To be honest, a lot of it was just a bunch of lads going playing golf and not seeing an issue with it. And in a way, that is the issue, that they didn't see that there was an issue with any of this.
I think, and there's and that unfortunately comes down to the rules don't apply to us in many ways, and some of that is, and we've seen, but I do think that that's changing. I genuinely do think that that's changing. I think we've seen, you know, Derek Lewis resigned very quickly. We have seen some stuff gone, you know, there's still echoes of it. I, again, speaking only for myself, I wasn't happy the way Phil Hogan conducted himself afterwards, and I actually thought some of the statements that have been said about him, as if you would imagine that you'd imagine genuinely that he had been had his head taken, because that is some of the stuff that has been said by senior people. You're saying, why are you using if I use that language online, I'd be accused of, you know, a mob or all of this sort of stuff. And but they use words like guillotine and calling for his head, and you're just going, lads, like, if I did that, you'd report me to Twitter, and I'd probably get in trouble for it. You know, there is a double standard there, and people are wary of it. Will the government be pressing forward with the program for government? Are they bound together now by this, and can they get the public confidence back?
I think one of the big things, and I said this a couple of days ago, was one of the, like, the main thing about getting the public confidence back is if the opening of schools goes well. If the opening of the schools goes well, if there will be an outbreak in a school, but if that's handled and the government can say, look, we spent ages on this roadmap to come back to open schools. Somebody, a kid, got it. There was an outbreak. They were isolated straight away. Our protocol kicked in and we absolutely crushed it. I think people will kind of go, okay, well, it feels like they're handling things. I think if there's a number of outbreaks in schools and it isn't dealt with, then the road to getting the public confidence back is going to be very, very long. I think, I think Irish people, they're very pragmatic in a way. So I think what will make people feel confident is if life goes back to normal in 6 months, if a vaccine arrives and the economy starts to reopen and we can go to concerts and we can hug our grannies again, then the vast majority of Irish people will kind of go, okay, well, I'm a little bit more comfortable now. I probably don't, you know, you probably, if you're predisposed not to like the government, or if you support one of the other parties, you're probably going to still criticize them. But that antsiness to see them tumble will dissipate a little bit, and you'll give them a bit more leeway. As far as they're kind of binding together internally, I think there's nobody really wants an election. I know there was some criticism. Fergus Finlay wrote it in our paper the other day, and then there was a lot of Twitter dunking on him because of it. He said that nobody really wanted an election. I think in politics, nobody really wants an election. I think some aspects of the public probably want an election. I don't see, like, chatting to TDs, even from opposition parties, just they don't know how it would run. They don't know how it would go. Right now, everyone's really weary. If the government collapsed today, you'd have to have an election and then pass a budget within your first week as the government, even if you swept in on a majority and you didn't have to negotiate a coalition. Right now, I think all of the opposition parties are very happy to let the current government deal with the next budget, which is only 6 weeks away. I don't get the sense that the government will fall anytime soon. I did have some, like, one Fine Gael member say to me the other day that they reckon they could be pre-Christmas. I don't see it, especially if there's a second lockdown, and if we're being told, look, your Christmas, you're not going to have the 12 pubs of Christmas, you're not going to have your Christmas party, you might not even be able to have your family over for Christmas. I don't think anyone's going to say, let's hop to the polls.
I think, though, there's two things going on there. I think there's clearly a political will, and I agree. I think the opposition also are quite content to let them plough on and stumble across and watch what happens around the schools, because this government needs a win. They need a win desperately. And then the second thing I would say in it, though, is the public probably wouldn't reward any of them for bringing an election at this stage. But at the same time, I can see something happening I thought this government would run at least four budgets, but you know what? I don't. The number of briefing within. You know, the room, the story of the first thing on the agenda with the left is always the split. Well, I tell you, these guys have really ramped that up to a huge level, and it's they really want you to know that they don't like one another.
Yeah, it's created an odd dynamic in that, you know, Fianna Fáil have said to me, and I did a long piece on Fianna Fáil last Monday, and it's on the Examiner website. It's 4,000 words. If you want to go and find it, took me ages to write. I'd appreciate it if you read it. But somebody I was chatting to was saying, like, you know, they were put in this position where, you know, I kind of couched it in that, you know, this was the party that told the Greens in 2007 that they were playing senior hurling, and the guy said to me, like, we're being played off the park here. But what is your option if you're Fianna Fáil, if the opinion polls have you at 12 or 13%, do you pull down the government because Leo Varadkar sent a tweet? Like, you'd want to be a lot braver than I feel about that decision. It has created an odd dynamic within the government. I think the problem is that there's generally and genuinely a will to try and find a way out of this. Oncoming COVID recession, to get the schools open, and that they're broadly in agreement on how to do that in a lot of ways. The problem is that, I suppose, it's when the credit comes, who's going to get the credit, and when the blame comes, who's going to get the blame, and that's where you're finding the kind of the friction. Because in the last government, you know, nobody in Fine Gael really worried about Shane Ross getting all of the credit for something. They just genuinely didn't. They didn't think, because even if the independents, if Shane Ross had a big win, then all he was doing was kind of helping himself. He was, this independent alliance was never anything more than a loose cobbling together of independents anyway. So, you know, it wasn't like they were going to take a seat from somebody in Limerick City because Shane Ross did something well. The problem with Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael is that in a lot of 3 and 4 seat constituencies, they're fighting over the balance of power. And when that happens, you've got a completely different dynamic at play.
Can I ask one last question for you? And, you know, it's the thing that we're all talking about now is the favourite so far in internal circles is a technocrat in the civil service who knows his way around the EU. But I won't even use names because it's unfair on people in that sphere. But in other ways, I don't see some politicians stepping aside and letting someone else take this if there's a good job there for them.
Yeah, well, look, the EU commissioner job is a great job.
That's what I mean.
Incredibly well paid, really, really high profile. I mean, the role that Phil Hogan was up for in the middle of the summer was the director general of the WTO. It's, you know, in real terms, it's probably one of the top 50 most powerful people in the world. Probably top 100. But, like, this is, you know, the next step on from EU commissioner is a massive, massive job. You spend 4 or 5 years doing that and you can go and do whatever you want, really. And the names that came to me over the weekend, you know, the first 3 names out of Fianna Fáil or out of Fine Gael mouths were Leo Varadkar, Pascal Donoghue, Simon Coveney. They are heavy, heavy hitters. And I think what you heard this morning from Brussels was kind of this, not a warning, but it was definitely an indication that, look, if you want to keep the trade portfolio, which some people say is very important, I think it's completely unknowable how important it is. But there is a reason that countries like Ireland, around about our size, jockey for a position to get it. If you want to get, if you want to keep that, you're going to need to send us a big name, and, you know, not a technocrat, not a career, you know, and the thing about it is that people like that are probably best placed to negotiate a trade deal, because they will probably know the ins and outs of it more astutely. But somebody like Simon Coveney is currently the favorite within Fine Gael. You know, we've been trying to track him down today. I think he was at a meeting somewhere. Where was he? He was attending the informal Foreign Affairs Council in Berlin remotely from Cork. So, you know, that's the word. And look, Simon Coveney has got very, very good feedback for his work on Brexit over the last 2 years. He understands the trade implications very, very intimately. He would be a huge name. The one thing that people in Fine Gael are saying to me, though, is that they're worried about any potential by-election.
Yeah.
Particularly his by-election will be interesting because the presumptive candidate for Fine Gael would be Jerry Butimer, who was also at the Oireachtas Gaelic Society event and has stood down as the last Gaelic of the Shannon. So the other candidate there would be Des Cahill, former mayor of Cork City, who was very, very strong on this from the beginning before he even knew who was at the event. He was calling for people to step down. So but no government wants to go off and fight a by-election that would be the Phil Hogan by-election.
Hmm.
And that's all it would be. You're not replacing the TD who goes off. You're replacing Phil Hogan. And Cork South Central is already, Simon Coveney's there, Micheál Martin's there, Michael McGrath, the Minister for Public Expenditure, is there, and then Donal Colera, the Sinn Féin candidate or the Sinn Féin TD. So it's already ripe for an anti-government candidate, even in the next election, if things stayed as they were. So I don't know, that's the balance that Fine Gael is going to have to find here. You're either going to have to sacrifice a big name or you're going to have to sacrifice the trade portfolio. Is kind of the devil in the deep blue sea for them. And I don't think they want to do either.
Yeah. No, that makes sense. Sorry, Linda, did I come across you again?
No, you're fine. It's an interesting one because I would be curious to see, because we've obviously been instructed now we have to send a male and a female candidate. So I don't know what names are getting bandied around for the female candidate. I would be very interested to see who that's going to be.
Mairead McGuinness was the first one to come to me. Vice President of the European Parliament, really, really, really highly thought of in Brussels, people in Brussels. I think that she's got an incredible handle on how the system works, and it's a really, like, it's a really complex and it's an arcane system, and people who know how to manoeuvre around it are kind of seen as really big assets. So the likelihood is that the government will probably put forward whoever their preferred nominee is and somebody of the other gender will kind of make it known to Ursula von der Leyen, we would prefer this person.
Yeah, well, look, Paul, we will watch and we'll keep an eye on, and people do go on to the Examiner website and check out Paul's long piece and support the journalism that's been done. You've done some great stuff, and back in the game since March, as himself, but Aoife told me to tell you that she is nearly, 7 days your senior in there, so just be clear,
She is, and that's I suppose that's one thing that's kind of been really, really helpful in a way, is that myself and Aoife have kind of gone through the same thing in terms of starting a new job at a time of really deep uncertainty, and then you have somebody to kind of you bounce things off and who is kind of like starting any job. If somebody starts in and around the same time as you kind of pal up, but I think
You both landed, two good people landed at the same time, and it's really worked. Political correspondent and proud Cork man, I'm obliged to say, proud Cork
Thank
man,
you.
Paul Hosford, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, guys.
Tony and Martin, Martin and Tony, speaking to interesting people only. It's the Echo Chamber Podcast. Subscribe now on Patreon.